Chapter 14, The Resilience Factor. While circumstances affect our mental health, the ability to rise above challenges and bounce back is the factor that dictates how much impact external events have on us. Emotional resilience means the capacity to adapt to and cope with stress, and to overcome adversity without becoming psychologically dysfunctional, such as slipping into a persistent negative mood or true clinical depression. You can think of resilience as emotional Teflon coating, a kind of hardiness that not only helps us cope with the stresses of everyday life, but also protects us when we're confronted by significant stressors or traumas. Less ego equals less need to control. Emotional resilience is born out of a belief in ourselves and a belief in something beyond ourselves. There is not always a why that we, the ego part, can understand from our limited perspective. Once we are willing to accept this, we no longer need to make sense of the unknowable. Of course, the ego cannot allow this. It needs to forge the unknowns of every size and impact into knowns. It is forever grasping at illogical straws and a futile attempt to explain the unexplainable. Our resilience is keyed to the acknowledgement that some of life's most painful ordeals are beyond our comprehension. If we accept, or better still, embrace the unknown, and that although we cannot fathom the why, we know it is geared toward our ultimate good, then we move toward emotional resiliency. If we allow our ego to get the better of us, then every bump and bruise is met with angry defiance, reinforcing the ego's message that we are bad and deserving of pain and punishment. The more egocentric a person is, the more the world revolves around him, and, due to low self-esteem, the more he believes himself deserving of pain and hardship. Thus, he concludes that everything is done to him, not for him, for some greater good, because, from his perspective, the universe and everyone in it hates him. The egocentric individual personalizes everything. It rains on his camping trip because he's not allowed to have a good time. The 8-car pileup that made him late for his meeting is similarly orchestrated to get back at him. It's all about him. As egocentricity expands, the person may become paranoid and believe himself to be the epicenter of causation for all that happens. We all flee to some degree. Everywhere you turn, there are convenient vehicles for mindless distraction. Instant entertainment offers escape into other worlds, a never-ending labyrinth of video games, movies, TV shows, blogs, and forums where we can dissociate from life's stressors. Each and every time we tune out rather than face the proverbial music, our resiliency gets dinged. When the constant chatter of the mind, the worries, fears, and anxieties, cannot be turned off, we tune out. We mute the uncomfortable noise of self-reflection and raise the volume of illusion. Scrolling through millions of Twitter feeds, researchers have found that users who suffer from depression frequently write about modes of distraction and escapism. Among the most recurring words are watch, movie time, episode, read, season, totally, book, favorite play, character, awesome, scene, star, stuff, cool, horror, and start. Psychologist and marketing guru Ernest Dichter, known as the father of motivational research, explains that when human beings become fearful, most will regress to soothing, even infantile behaviors, and animalistic drives to distract themselves from and channel their anxiety. This is the psychology behind the typically high-sugar, fat-saturated, or salt-laden go-to comfort foods. They provide a feeling of fullness instead of emptiness and tend to elevate our mood, albeit briefly. They create a short-lived feeling of well-being by stimulating the brain's reward system, which, temporarily, dampens emotional distress. This observation is particularly useful because it reveals how people manage stress in their lives in general. Terror management theory explains that we deal with anxiety in one of two ways. When we are living full and robust lives, we tend to embrace our values and beliefs, that which brings meaning into our lives. This is known as the mortality salience hypothesis and promotes self-regulation. But if we are living less than meaningful lives, we pacify our fears with self-indulgence, from chocolate to vacations. This is known as the anxiety buffer hypothesis. Ever wonder why the ads during the evening news are often for products that enable escapism? Studies have found that news of disaster and death makes viewers shift to a mentality of, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die." In other words, sad news makes you want to indulge and to seek immediate gratification. The Achilles heel of impulse control lies in how we manage our fears. This is valuable to understand because in any number of scenarios, such as a date, negotiation, or interview, how people typically respond to anxiety-provoking situations echoes their mental health. Do they see, accept, and respond? React, and then regret? Or just plain duck and hide? When we're confronted with a stressor, we appraise the situation, then decide how to respond. Taking breaks from your work, for example, is a good thing. However, if you have anxiety about the work, those breaks should prompt you to work through anxiety, not avoid it. If you close the laptop and walk away during a wave of anxiety, you reinforce a pattern of escapism. Flee, and you temporarily lessen the anxiety, but reinforce the neural pattern that avoidance brings calm and comfort. That calm is short-lived because it is soon replaced with guilt, which is anger turned inward. The anger and anxiety loop continues to reinforce itself. Among the most important triggers of self-regulation failure, what makes us lose self-control and give in to our impulses, is anger. Predictably, anger gives way to a range of self-destructive behaviors and habits, such as alcoholism, gambling, and drug addiction. Have you ever noticed that when you are angry with yourself, you are more prone to bang into things or knock them over? That's emotional discombobulation, being angry with yourself, manifesting physically. Maybe you're flushed and distracted, and so you literally didn't see that table. But it's also psychologically probable that you're experiencing an unconscious attempt to punish yourself because you made a decision that you knew was not right, even though you could not help yourself at the time. More simply put, guilt is a negative force that weighs us down, causing us to engage in unconsciously motivated self-destructive behavior. According to a study of more than 2,500 patients who had been seriously injured and sought care in the emergency room, researchers found that 31.7% reported some degree of irritability just before the injury. 18.1% reported feeling angry, and 13.2% reported feeling hostile. The over-under. The quality of our emotional lives is directly proportional to the amount of responsibility we are willing to accept. In Reality Therapy, renowned psychiatrist Dr. William Glasser writes, "People do not act irresponsibly because they are ill. They are ill because they act irresponsibly." But how do we measure authentic responsibility? The question is not as simple as you might assume, because people who suffer from a personality disorder will either under-control or over-control their impulses. What looks like robust emotional health and strong conviction to moral values and ideals may be something else entirely. There's an age-old riddle that asks, how far can you go into a forest? The answer is halfway, because after you reach the middle, you're beginning to come out. In Gauging Emotional Well-Being, we're often looking for the middle of the forest, balance and moderation. When exhibited in the extreme, practically any attitude or behavior, no matter how admirable or reasonable, begins to drift into that gnarly thicket of being unhealthy. For example, cleanliness is a virtue, unless someone becomes so obsessed with being clean that they clean constantly, frantically, and compulsively, to the point that they are cleaning things that were already clean. Having a degree of openness and receptiveness is a positive and healthy trait, of course. So is being appropriately cautious and reserved. But when we move into either extreme, we're drifting into unhealthy territory. Likewise, dedication to exercise is a positive, healthy attribute. However, running with a broken foot because you feel you must get your exercise in is clearly not a good sign. The behavior is dangerous and represents neither discipline nor wisdom, but its opposite: foolishness and a lack of self-restraint. Almost any admirable trait has an unhealthy counterpart. For example, 1. Being affectionate is positive, while being distant or indifferent is not. Yet being too clingy is unhealthy. 2. Showing courage is positive, while cowering is not. Yet being brazen is unhealthy. 3. Having determination is positive, while being indecisive and unsure is not. Yet close-mindedness is unhealthy. 4. Being flexible is positive, while being rigid and stubborn is not. Yet not having a backbone is unhealthy. And 5. Trusting others is positive, while being paranoid is not. Yet being too naive is unhealthy. A lack of impulse control can manifest as frequent disregard for both oneself and others. Does someone pay their credit card bills on time and live within their means? Or are they careless or irresponsible with their money? Are they thoughtful and calculating in their decisions? Or do they engage in high-risk behavior, demonstrate poor judgment, and exhibit recklessness with their own safety and that of others? Do they think things through and consider the consequences? Or would they be described as someone who makes rash and brash decisions? At the same time, we want to pay attention to extremes, such as a person who is incapable of taking responsible risks and investing in themselves. A rigid and persistent overcontrol of oneself may signal a hidden personality disorder. Those with avoidant personality disorder, for example, are afraid of venturing into social settings for fear of ridicule or scorn. Similarly, people suffering from an obsessive-compulsive personality disorder operate with an intense fear of being bad or wrong. As such, their overactive conscience drives them to be overly scrupulous and hyper-focused on rules and regulations. This is true in every domain. There are those who challenge authority at every turn because they have no respect for it, let alone social norms. At the same time, there are those who are afraid to bend or break even the most minor rule because they fear the consequences and have a disproportionate fear of authority. Much more goes into the psychological mix because not only are there many classifications of mental illness, but also a mind-numbing number of gradations. The challenge of identifying the problem is further compounded because they often intertwine or overlap with a comorbidity rate of 90%. When a person has one personality disorder, they are likely to have at least one additional personality disorder, as well as an increased likelihood of anxiety and depression. In Part 4, my profiling system allows you to tell whether someone is emotionally unwell without you having to assume a formal diagnosis. It is designed to offer insight into a person's mental framework, not label them with a specific illness or disorder, although we will zero in on certain conditions. This gives you the ability to know how far an individual deviates from being emotionally healthy, rather than pathologizing their symptoms into one immutable diagnosis.